Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Record Lab podcast. My name is Nathan. I'm a songwriter, music producer, and audio engineer from Toronto, Canada. On today's episode, we have a very special guest. He is an audio engineer, also here in Toronto. He specializes in recording, mixing, and mastering. He has worked with some pretty cool people over the years, including Pressa, Tory Lanez, Houdini, Popcan, like a bunch of cool people. He also is the founder of Risk Engineering, where he really provides artists and helps them take that extra step to make it sound like a radio-ready record. Okay, without further ado, I'd like to welcome Ty Dinelli to the Record Lab podcast.
Thank you, man. I appreciate you having me on.
Of course. Thank you so much for being here.
And thank you for the nice intro.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. I guess a question I like to ask the guests when they first come in is like, how did you start getting into music? Was it like growing up? Were you interested in it? Or how did you kind of take that as your career path and kind of lead into that?
Yeah, I mean, like a lot of people in our industry, it goes back to like when I was young, mm-hmm. Just playing guitar as a kid kind of thing. My dad was always a guitar player, so I kind of followed his steps and was in and out of bands and stuff like that. And then a bit later on, I kind of switched to more digital creating, a lot of hip hop, R&B, pop music, that kind of stuff. And that's where I really kind of like, I felt good. You know what I mean? So yeah. I just kind of stuck with that. I really had no clue like where it was going to go. I just really enjoyed kind of making beats and recording my buddies in my parents' basement kind of thing, like just for fun. And it quickly just kind of turned into something where I was like, I was wanting to do this like day and night, every single day. Mm-hmm. I just like completely fell in love with it. A few steps here and there, and it kind of turned into a career, thankfully, mm-hmm. from just being a hobby.
Yeah. That's awesome. Did you like pursue an education in it as well, or are you completely self-taught?
So I went to Metalworks in Mississauga here.
Okay.
I took their 1 year like audio engineering music production course. It's just kind of a quick thing. Mm-hmm. Did that and still really didn't know like, because I grew up in Winnipeg and I moved here like just to kind of do that 1 year of school. And I had no clue like what was going to happen after. I was like, do I just go back to Winnipeg, make something happen there? Do I try to stay out here, try to make something happen? And I ended up staying here just to see. I was like, if it works, it works. If it doesn't, then I'll go back home. And that was about, I want to say 15 years ago, and I'm still in Toronto. So it's thankfully and, you know, gratefully it's been working.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. Yeah. So did you find like after graduating school, did you think there was still like a lot to learn too with the 1 year program?
Tons.
Yeah.
Tons, man.
Yeah.
And I'm not necessarily like a lot of people ask me these days, like if they think they should go to school for audio engineering. And these days, like back in the day, like kind of when I went, like I said, this, we're going back like 14-ish years ago. Mm-hmm. There wasn't as much accessible on like YouTube and stuff like that as there is today. Right. Yeah. And there's other people these days, like myself included, that I offer like kind of one-on-one courses that I can do with people here at my home studio in Toronto, or we can do it virtually if you're not in the GTA, where I just teach you like exactly what you want to learn. If you want to learn mixing techniques, mastering stuff, recording, gear, like whatever, we just go over exactly kind of what you want to learn. And we just do it to the level that I would have wanted when I was kind of starting out. So I always tell people school isn't necessarily necessary these days, especially for the cost of it. A lot of times it's tens of thousands of dollars, right?
Yeah.
Where I say you can put a quarter of that into, you know, doing a one-on-one course with someone like me or someone else or something like that and get really straight up valuable information. Instead of doing school where you're kind of learning some stuff you do like, some stuff you don't like, and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then you can take some of the money that you would have put into school and invested into some equipment that you might need to get yourself started, maybe a good computer, that kind of thing. So these days, I always kind of, I'm not saying the schools are bad, you know what I mean? But for me personally, all the stuff I learned after school is all the stuff that I know today.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree with you more on that because I also did a 1 year program in audio engineering and music production in Toronto.
Sure.
And I find like, I will always credit that. I think like maybe 20 to 80, the 80% of what I learned is from surrounding myself with other engineers, getting into studios and learning from them and learning their techniques. And then also
exactly.
like my own learning. To this day, I still like, yeah, I graduated school, but yeah. even yesterday, like I'm watching like a video on YouTube of this mixing engineer going through his mix chain and like doing stuff like that. Like there's so much to learn when it comes to it. And I think,
yeah,
I agree with you. Like school, yeah, it's like good and you'll learn some stuff from it, but also just learning outside of the education system and learning from people who are in the industry and who are actually doing it every day. And then that 100%. Way you can get into the stuff you're interested in, or it's like, if you're really interested in mixing,
yeah.
then you can find a mixing engineer who can teach you their techniques and stuff. And then you can exactly. learn that rather than learning from like a textbook and like, you should do this because that's what the book says. It's like, you yeah. can learn so many different things just from other people. And I think that's really important.
Bro, and you know what it is too? It's like the experience of you just kind of doing it. Is exactly. so much more exactly. that you get so much more out of that than you do from school, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's really just like doing the work and just practicing and getting better and like working with different artists who have different voices or different styles and just trying a bunch of different things and just getting your ears trained and used to kind of how things should sound and
for sure
studying great mixes and stuff like that. A lot of things these days you can kind of do on your own, or like I said, mm-hmm. kind of like with a mentor, like someone like me who offers kind of courses. So that's, yeah, there's a lot you can do on your own in this industry these days.
Yeah, like for sure. Back to what you said, like ear training, I think that's crucial when you're learning sure. how to mix or even learning like recording stuff in general, because a lot of the time too, especially me when I was starting out, it's like, oh, you need EQ and compression. I'm just going to throw any EQ and compression on there just for the sake of it, compared to actually yeah. learning what it's doing and learning it with your ears. Like, especially compression, like once you kind of unlock that skill and your yeah. ears learn what it's doing, you can really start to become artistic with it and agreed. Really play into different compressors and different tones and stuff, and how much you're compressing a vocal or yeah. any instrument based on the sound you are going for. And once you understand that, like with your ears, I think that will improve not only your mixing skills, but your creativity too.
Totally agree, man.
Yeah.
Or knowing like when you don't need to compress.
Yeah.
You know what
yeah.
I mean? Because a lot of times mm-hmm. people just think, yo, you got to throw a compressor on everything.
Yeah.
But like if you have a beat stem from a producer that you're working with and you can tell it's already like just, it's yeah. already leveled. Like you don't yeah. need to compress something that's already kind of been compressed or that's already mm-hmm. kind of like locked in. So all those little things are just kind of, it's again, it's trial and error and just experimenting mm-hmm. and seeing, finding out for yourself. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially yeah. like even what you said, like beat stems from stuff, like any splice samples, those are like compressed, let alone like master all of them yeah. too. So you really got to think about that when you're like dragging files in and that, like sound yeah. wise too and level wise. It's like, do you really need to compress this more? This vocal that's definitely been run through like a preamp compressor, then compressed again inside a DAW sure. and then like ran out.
Exactly, yeah. man.
Yeah. Kind of leaning into the side of like making records and on that conversation, sure. what do you find yourself enjoying the most to do, whether it be recording, mixing, mastering?
I would say these days, mixing and mastering is kind of my main kind of thing, especially like even over the past maybe 2-3-ish years kind of thing, especially like after COVID, a yeah. lot of people figured out like, hey, if I can't go to the studio, I'm going to bring the studio to me. So they just got little home setups where they kind of mm-hmm. have their own mic and interface kind of thing and just started recording on their own, but realizing, hey, I can record on my own, but my mixes are terrible. So I still got to send those out
yeah.
to Ty or whoever, you know what I mean? So I find myself over the past, like I said, 2 or 3 years, maybe doing less and less recording, mm-hmm. but more mixing. And I kind of, yeah. I like that for me personally, because I find the mixing and mastering process to be more, it's a little bit more creative, and I have mm-hmm. more control, especially with a lot of my clients. They trust me with kind of creative control and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So a lot of times they say like, please like do whatever you think is necessary for the song, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's fun for me, just kind of sitting in my room and just, I'm by myself. I don't have anybody yeah. like yapping in my ear or telling me to do this yeah. or that. So for me, it's mixing and mastering for sure. But recording's still fun. If you're with the right artist and the vibe is nice and
yeah.
it's a talented artist that you're working with, it's great because the chemistry is always so real. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But, you know, a lot of times recording can kind of get redundant and it's kind of the same thing over and over, especially if you're not working with the most talented artists.
Yeah.
Which happens, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But it's our job as engineers to try to make them sound as good as they possibly can. And,
yeah.
But you know, like I said, sometimes it gets a little redundant when you're just kind of hitting record, telling them good, no, bad, yes. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. Cause it's like when you're recording someone, for example, like you said, like isn't the best or that, it's like, sometimes it's fun to have a challenge. But sometimes sure. It's also so much easier when someone can actually just like sing and do stuff that you're like, oh, this is making this recording process fly by easily.
Yeah, exactly.
That's, I find, like a much more pleasant experience to deal with.
100%.
Yeah. It just makes your, not only your life easier, but also like from a creative aspect, you're able to bounce off of each other way easier if there's like a good chemistry and the person's talented. A lot of the times when I've recorded people, because I can sing as well, it's like, if I want them to do something, I'll just sing it for them. And then they hear it right away and then they sing it back. And then it's smooth sailing. And then you're just able to track vocals so much easier that way.
Exactly.
Yeah. But the mixing and mastering too of it all, it's like an introvert's dream. It's like, they just get to be by themselves and just like do their own thing. But as much as you need like the technical side of it and ear training and all that stuff, it's very creative as well. And like you can, once you start learning the techniques and the fundamentals of it all, that's how you can start putting your own style into it. Being like, this is how Ty mixes things. And this is how he does it. And it's going to sound different than another mixing engineer. But that's because it's like your stylistic, artistic choice, which I think is really cool.
Well, and that's the thing. And it's not like you necessarily have to always like move mountains. Like you don't want to take someone's mix and just make it something completely different than what they gave you. But it's just adding the odd little thing here or there, like, you know, just the odd production change. Like if you drop the beat and on a certain line or something like that, or maybe you chop apart from the vocal and use it on the intro, but in some weird effect or something like that, or like little things like that, that when you send it back to the client, usually they're like, holy shit, like that wasn't even, I didn't give you that. Like you just created that from something that was there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And most times they're super like thankful and grateful that you kind of go that extra mile instead of just like cleaning the track up, making it sound good.
Yeah.
You also add your kind of artistic, creative touch to it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some people, you know, you've got to judge the client. Like, do they want like the reference mix that they sent you just kind of cleaned up and that's it?
Mm-hmm.
Or do they say, hey, I'd like you to kind of like, please have creative control, you know?
Yeah.
So there's a time and place and knowing the client that you're dealing with of how far you can kind of push things.
Mm-hmm. Kind of leading into that topic too, finding client-wise too, how would you find yourself like starting out, like finding more clients and building your clientele up?
Like me personally or just in general, like today?
Or I guess you personally, like kind of how like you started it.
Yeah. So again, we're going back. So this May will actually be my, I think, 12th year like in business. Like that's just been my career. Thank you. Appreciate it. So going back to like that first year kind of thing, a lot of that was just me kind of working. And again, like I came out to Toronto knowing nobody, right? So I just met a few guys at school and then they introduced me to some friends of theirs who maybe rapped or sang or whatever. So I met a few people like that and then was just kind of working for free just to kind of build my experience and that kind of thing. And then eventually kind of realized, because at that same time, like when I finished school, I started applying for internships at different studios around Toronto and either just didn't get a call back or email back, or I would and they'd say, hey, sorry, we're not looking for anyone right now. That's why I kind of started doing my own thing and realized, hey, these people keep coming back. So now instead of just doing it for free, let me charge them a little bit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then whenever they would come, you know, because of what I've done for them already, they were super like thankful and they're like, yeah, sure, we'll toss you a few bucks. And then I would always say like, hey, you know, and if you don't mind, like at the end of the session, if you have any friends or anybody that's in music, please like feel free to send them my way.
Yeah.
And so a lot of my first kind of clientele was just kind of word of mouth like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like just try to do a good job in the session or for a mix for somebody and just like, hey man, please, can you like pass my name on to some of your buddies or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot more came from social media when I started really kind of going hard on there. And back in the day, it was more like Facebook was kind of still the big thing. It wasn't like Instagram and TikTok how it is now kind of thing. But back then it was Facebook, and there was I just randomly like stumbled upon like a Facebook like group page called Toronto Rappers. And there were just like thousands of like members in this group, and everyone would post their song on like the feed and stuff like that. And I saw that one day and I was like, bro, this is a gold mine. Like this is thousands of people in Toronto that rap or sing or whatever that I could just approach and be like, hey, I'd love to have it. So I'd send out like DMs to people and really like customize the DM. You know what I mean? Like I'd make it really personable to the artist I was reaching out to. I'd check some of their music out on YouTube or whatever. And I'd say, hey man, I love this song that you did. Like love your flow or love your lyrics or that kind of thing. I'm an engineer in Toronto. I'd love to have you down for a session sometime. So I would send like hundreds of messages out like every week kind of thing to people. And you know, maybe you'd hear back from 30-40% of them. And then from those 30-40%, maybe you'd get like 20% that would actually be down to come in to record or mix with you kind of thing. But man, that was like a gold mine because I gained so many clients just from sending out messages like that. And the same thing could apply today. Like you could do the exact same thing on TikTok or Instagram, Twitter, whatever, or X, whatever. That same kind of method like applies to today of just like that online grind. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
So after that, that was kind of like my word of mouth kind of got me from nothing to here. And then that social media push got me from here like to up here. And then from there, it was just more word of mouth and doing a good job for people and just being a good person at the end of the day. Like you can be the greatest engineer, but if you're just a kind of a shitty guy or a girl, whatever, like you're not going to get that return business, you know? So at the end of the day, it's doing a good job for people and being professional, but also just being a good person.
Yeah, I think so too. Like I've talked about this a lot on other episodes too, but it's like just having the chemistry with the person you're working with is so like important.
It's crucial. It's
like, especially in recording, but also just like building connection wise too. It's like, why would you want to send your mix off to like an asshole that's just like not fun to work with or like just
exactly, man.
Like, you want to work with people that are like-minded and everyone has the same idea. Like we want to make a song that sounds amazing and turn it into a record that everyone's proud of and everyone wants to release, not someone that has like a negative attitude about it. I think that's really cool. How did you find yourself like getting, because I know you've worked with some pretty like big artists, how did you find yourself kind of taking yourself from like here, like with the Facebook group, to like kind of moving up working with more high-end people?
So that all just kind of happened organically, to be honest. That was never like any kind of bigger artists I've worked with has never been from me like reaching out to them or anything. It's just kind of happened organically. Like either they've found me from something that I've done that they've heard, or there's somebody like in my, you know, close circle of colleagues or friends or something like that, that have kind of said, hey, this person's in town. They're looking for an engineer. Can I give them your number kind of thing? So it's all about like the connections and stuff that you make over these years. And that's something that's so crucial as an engineer and producer is actually like going out and networking and not like not just focusing on like the social media networking, but also just like going to, I don't know, going to events or shows or just bars or whatever, where you know there's going to be some artists around or other producers that you can just kind of talk and network with and give them your card or your Instagram or whatever, you know what I mean? So it's really about like a good combination of in-person networking and social media networking at the same time. That's really going to kind of plug you into the right person because you never know. You know what I mean? And that's the point. Sometimes you just get lucky. You're in the right place at the right time and you shake the right hand or something like that. And then they introduce you to somebody who's a little bigger or something like that. And then you just kind of capitalize off that.
Yeah, for sure. Kind of leaning into that topic a little bit. I kind of wanted to talk about like a record that you worked on called Do It by Houdini, Pressa, and 5EO Foreign. Sure. Can you kind of like talk about like how that came to you and then the roles you played making that record?
Yeah, so same thing, man. That just came from just my network. Like that was somebody that I knew who was kind of close to Houdini. Rest in peace to Houdini. But he was always around him back in the day. And me and this guy have a connection. He was the one that said, hey, Ty should kind of, like, he's a good engineer. He should take this.
Yeah.
So they originally came to me to just kind of master the whole album because it was already, I guess, like a lot of songs were mixed already. So I was just supposed to kind of master the whole thing. But then they said, hey, we've got this one song that, you know, could be mixed as well. Like, can you do that? So I said, oh, yeah, of course. Like, I'd love to. So that was the one that I fully like mixed and mastered. And the rest of the project, I just kind of mastered.
Yeah,
but that's really how it came. Like, it wasn't like me reaching out to anybody. That was just organic. Like, it just, you know, you connect the dots sometimes.
Yeah. Kind of taking us like into that like mixing process. Like, let's say you get like the Pro Tools session and everything. Like, where would you start from there in your ideal mix?
So for me, it's always the editing first, all the kind of grunt work, you know, cleaning up, you know, dead space on vocal tracks or organizing things. I'm super key on just like organization in my Pro Tools sessions, color coding things, labeling things, just arranging things how they need to so I can visually kind of see where things are. And everyone's got their own like, you know, arranging methods of color coding and that kind of stuff. So I always go through that first. Any tuning that I need to do, although I think they had auto-tune printed.
Oh, okay.
But usually I would kind of tune things with like Melodyne if I feel it's necessary. Once I've done kind of all the editing, I'll usually start with the like the beat stems first. I'll mix that, like get the beat sounding how I want it to sound, and then kind of carve the vocals like into that.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, you know, editing, beat mixing, vocal mixing, kind of making sure everything's kind of balanced the way I need to kind of near the end, and then mastering, running stuff through gear and that kind of thing. And then, you know, printing, and that's it.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Like, another question that I was honestly curious about, like with your, I know you do a lot of analog mixing as well. Like, you do in the box, but also analog.
Yeah.
Can you kind of take us through that process of, let's say your mix is really good in the box right now, but you want to run it through some gear. How would you do that based on like your home setup?
Yeah. So let's say, because a lot of times I use gear like on my mix bus.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like the whole song is kind of getting touched by the gear, right? A lot of things that I'll use on my mix bus, like this thing right here, the Audioscape kind of, it's a stereo Poltec.
Yeah.
That they released earlier this year, actually. And it's insane. Like, to anybody that wants to know, it is a fantastic piece of gear. And just having it stereo and not needing two units that take up like a ton of rack space is great. So that's something I'll use on my mix bus a lot. I've got a bus compressor right here that I use a lot to kind of glue things in. And then on top of my desk here, I've got my 500 series kind of stuff where I've got a couple Rupert Neve 542 tape emulators that kind of add a nice saturation or a nice depth. I've got an SPL big stereo imager, which kind of can add nice width and more depth. So those things specifically I'll use on my mix bus. And then I've got other things as well that are just mono units, like the Moog EQ4 sounds amazing on vocals. That airband is like fantastic for just getting that like nice shiny air sound on a vocal. And then other, you know, I'm big on like vocal compression with analog. So like using the 1176 or the LA-2A from Audioscape at the bottom here. I'm big on analog vocal compression compared to digital compression.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
So that's kind of a rundown. And, you know, I've got everything wired into my interface and then routed in my in Pro Tools so that everything can kind of go out to the gear and then back into Pro Tools and, you know, use it as almost like, use it as an insert. So you're using it like a plugin and you're just doing it live, right?
That's really cool. And that's like much more simpler than I thought too, because I know patch bays like are a lot of like, they're very common, but Yeah, because I was curious of how you do that, because I noticed you use a lot of analog gear in your mixes, and kind of like that step of like doing it in the box and then taking it out of the box too. And the fact that you use that on your mix bus too, that makes like a lot of sense, because it's like, okay, like you did your whole mix in Pro Tools. Now let's give it that analog feeling that it needs and that analog like clarity that it needs. And yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah. So that's pretty much it. Like everything's, and you know, the question I get a lot is like, why don't you have the patch bay? And for me, it's like, A, it's easier for me because I'm not changing things around very often.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I just kind of use things how I know I'm going to use them. So I've just got them kind of hardwired right into the Apollo X8, where I know like I don't need to change this around. I don't need to patch this into this and then into this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So everything is just kind of going directly into the Apollo. And there's a couple things I've got going into the, I've got an Apollo twin on the desk as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm using kind of the 10 IOs from both of those in total.
Like you said, like you're not doing like much recording
of having to
either. That it's like you don't, you can take advantage of all those inputs and all the things that come with the Apollo strips and the,
exactly.
Yeah. No, that's very cool. That's a,
well, I should say I've always got my one kind of vocal chain set up, which is the Neve 1073. And usually I've got it going into the LA2A. Like I like that kind of style of compression during recording.
Yeah.
So that's kind of always like patched in as my like vocal chain, but then everything else is used in the mix.
Yeah.
Or mastering stage.
Yeah. I love the Neve 1073. That's one of my favorite preamps out there.
Oh, it's fantastic, man. You can't go wrong.
Yeah. This just has such like a nice like tone to it and a nice shine that I really like on a vocal.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. That kind of leads into my next question too. So let's say it's like an ideal like recording session setup. Yeah. How would like kind of walk us through that and like what preamp would you use, compressor or microphone?
Okay. Are we talking like if money isn't an issue and I've just got my like access to anything?
Yeah, let's do that. That's fun.
Okay. Sounds good. So just to like play it safe, you know what I mean? Because some mics don't sound good on certain artists and stuff like that. Like a lot of people like the Sony C800, which is, you know, it's a great mic, but I've used that in sessions and it does not sound good on every artist because it's a very bright microphone, right? Mm-hmm. So people always see that and be like, that's the GOAT mic and, you know, that kind of thing. But for me, the GOAT microphone is the Telefunken 251.
I've heard that a lot too, yeah.
Yeah, I've had the chance of using it a few times in like other studios. And anytime like I'm working in a studio and they have that mic, there's 100% chance that's what I'm picking, no matter like who the artist is.
Yeah.
Because that mic just sounds so clean and just so buttery on just any style of vocal.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like my all-time like microphone if I could choose like any kind of mic. Mm-hmm. After that, I would definitely just go into a Neve like 1073.
Mm-hmm.
And compressor, I'd either go, this could be a toss up. This could be a toss up depending on like the vocalist that I'm working with.
Yeah.
I like CL1Bs a lot of the time because they're very like clean and transparent. And even when, like if you dial in a good amount of compression, it still doesn't sound compressed. Like it doesn't sound overly squashed. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. A lot can go like a little way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure.
So CL1Bs are great, but I'm a huge fan of 1176s as well.
Yeah, me too.
And I know like I said like I track with like my 2A, well, the 2A from Audioscape, but I don't know. In a perfect world, like if I could have like a blue stripe, like an original blue stripe 1176, like a vintage one. Those things are crazy, man.
Yeah. No, I'm the same way, like with the preamp choices and compressor choices. Like I love my Neve 1073 and I also love the CO1B. I use a lot of it like when I'm in like using just my laptop and my Apollo, I use the Unison preamp and then the plugin.
Yeah.
But I also like I went to LA back in September and I got to use the actual like hardware gear and it was great. It's like it was amazing. But I'm the same way with the 1176 too. Like I've been kind of switching between the CO1B and the 1176.
Yeah.
Kind of depending just like on the vibe I'm going for a little bit. too.
Well, that's the thing, because the 1176 definitely has more, it has more tone or more of a color than the CL1B, which I say can sound a little kind of transparent, which can be great if that's what you want. But if you want a bit of kind of saturation, then the 1176 is fantastic for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of going into like, I know you mentioned that you recorded PopCam before, and I just kind of like that experience of like how that came to be and your experience recording with him.
Yeah. So that came again, just organically through, we're like kind of colleagues, like we do different things, but we're in the same like kind of music world in a sense.
Yeah.
Shout out to my boy Astral. He kind of set that up. Cause he's kind of in good with a lot of the OVO guys and stuff like that. So, when PopCon was in, he needed like a engineer for a session. So I pulled up to, Orange Lounge in Toronto and did the session there. And I've had a few sessions with him actually, like after that as well. So that was, that's how that kind of came about. But the sessions themselves were great, man. Like he's super talented, obviously. And the way that he works is really unique. Like he'll go in, pop a beat in the session, really just kind of like start humming melodies and getting the flows in place that he wants. And then he'll go on the mic and just kind of like do some lines here and there, come back out, hum some more kind of melodies, go back in. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of kind of like in and out of the booth that we were doing with him. And man, those were some cool sessions for sure.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. When something like that is happening too, like from a writing standpoint too, do you find you just like to stick in your lane with engineering, or do you kind of give like some creative input on like word choices or lyric choices and all that? Or do you like to stick mainly just to the engineering side of things?
I usually like to stay in my lane, especially with an artist like that, who's like, he knows what he's doing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If it's a kind of an up and coming artist, or they're just starting out, that kind of thing, and maybe their pen game isn't the greatest, or maybe they're adding too many words or too many syllables into a line. Mm-hmm. That's when I'll step in and say like, hey, you know, you could probably take this word out and everything will flow a lot better.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Plus when you're working with someone like on that level, who's just so established already and so talented, like you don't need to say that much, you know? Mm-hmm. So in those kind of instances, I just kind of like to bring the best out of them from an engineering standpoint, and not necessarily from a creative standpoint, but you're still creative at the same time. Mm-hmm. But I don't like to say like, hey man, you should say this, or you should sing this, or you know what I mean? Cause they usually just, they have it already.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. Like I understand that you work a lot like in hip hop, like in that genre. And a question I like to ask all the guests too, like musical influence wise, like does the music that you listen to and that you like to listen to reflect the type of music that you make?
That's a tough one, because I tell people this all the time, like maybe I'm mixing or recording with a hip hop artist all day, right? Or an R&B artist, or I'm mixing an R&B song all day, right?
Yeah.
When I'm done and I'm just kind of hanging out at night, or maybe I'm just making dinner or something like that, and I want to put some music on, I want to put something on completely different from what I've been working on all day. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If I've been working on hip hop for 12 hours in the day, I don't want to keep listening to hip hop when I'm just kind of in my own time. I'll throw on like classic rock or jazz or reggae or something, you know, like something completely different from what I've been listening to, just to kind of refresh my ears and stuff like that.
Yeah, for sure.
So my taste of music can be all over the place, man, like completely all over the place. And I think it kind of needs to be when you're an engineer or producer. And just because like I've kind of made my name and my brand around a lot of like hip hop, R&B, pop music, it's still so good to listen to other music to know why that music is good.
Yeah, for sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I've talked about this a lot on some of the other episodes. It's like experimenting in different genres and just listening to different genres, you can pick up certain things in that you can then implement in your own
exactly
choice and kind of mix it up. And I think just listening to music in general, even if it's not in your like specific genre, it's gonna increase your skills a lot, and it's gonna help you become more creative.
Totally. And especially like for engineers, I tell people all the time, like listen to the Beatles or something like that. Like, and you know, these are younger engineers who might not even know who the Beatles are, you know what I mean? But it's like, go back and listen to like what made this great music. Like, even though you might not like it, it might not be your cup of tea, it still changed a completely, like, it changed the world's taste of music at that time. You know what I mean? So why, like, why was that? What was done in the mixing stages that made it sound the way it sounded? Like, why did people like that? Or go back and listen to like a Michael Jackson album or something like that. Why, like, why was that so, why was it so big? You know what I mean? From, and just touch it from a mixing standpoint. Like, what made those mixes just resonate with people in that, in the way that it did? So again, even though it might not be your cup of tea, just go back and listen to things and study why they were great.
Yeah. And even like you said, from a mixing standpoint, genre wise, like, I'm just thinking too, like, even if an artist on the same album, there could be songs on there that are mixed by the same person, but they're mixed differently because of the genre choice that they're going for. And like, what if one song's different than another song? Totally drastic. A record I'm thinking of right now is Guts by Olivia Rodrigo. You have the opening single, Vampire, which is like a sad ballad. And then you have another song on the record, Ballad of a Homeschool Girl, where it's like very rock-based, heavy, like distorted, gritty vocals. It's like the two contrast each other, but learning to mix and understanding this song needs to be mixed a little more because it's very rock. It's very, you can't mix it the exact same way as the ballady song.
No, it's got to be a little grittier or a little more saturated or something, right?
Yeah. And that, once again, it goes back into how mixing is really artistic and really creative and stylistic by mixing it in different ways to make that feeling more like pronounced and more understandable by the listener.
I totally agree. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it's time to get into like one of my favorite parts is asking your favorite like plugins and your favorite VSTs and compressors and EQs and all of that stuff.
Okay.
So, what would you say is like your top like three plugins?
Okay, so I don't think I could live without Pro Q4.
Oh, okay. I've heard really good things about that one. I'm still on three, but I've heard four.
I mean, three's still great too, but four just kind of took it up a level, you know?
Yeah.
So that's just something that I can use on anything, right? Mm-hmm. Like I, and especially with Pro Q4 when they added the spectral mode where you can kind of use it almost like soothe, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
That was a big game changer for me personally. Just because you can use it in so many different kind of aspects. Mm-hmm. So that's a big one for me. That's on every single mix I ever do. So that would be EQ. Do you want me to pick like a compressor?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. This is where it gets tricky.
Yeah. Cause there's so many and they all do different. They all do the same thing, but different at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. Let's say I'm using it for vocals or something like that, right?
Yeah.
I would probably go, damn, this is hard.
You can give two if you want. You can give an opto and an
effect. Well, because I was going to say, because like I said, a lot of times like I'll use like analog compression.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, but let's just say because I have an 1176 and I have like a two-way style compressor, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not going to pick those for my plug-in choice. So I might go, and this might be kind of a curveball because it's not like the most elaborate compressor out there, but Arvox.
I love that compressor.
Right? Yeah. It's just it's so easy to use and it just does something to a vocal or anything really. That just, it's got this sound to it that I can't quite like pinpoint, but it just sounds good all the damn time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's, or, I find I like the Fairchild compressor by UAD.
Yeah, I've been using that one a lot more recently.
Yeah, I always find that adds like a really nice lift to things.
Yeah,
like it's kind of in the high to mid kind of range. It just kind of pulls things together really nicely.
Yeah.
So those would be like two of my like probably most used compressors, I'd say.
Yeah, no, both of those I use all the time too. And it's funny because I use them in a way where I'm not using them for the sake of compressing. It's a lot of it, like you said, it's like that tone that it gives and that kind of both of them like really lift something up and they lift, especially like a vocal up into it without compressing and squashing it like a lot.
Exactly.
But yeah, no, those are two really good choices.
Yeah. And then any other kind of categories you want me to touch?
We've covered preamp because we need 1073 supremacy, but how about like a reverb?
Reverb. My go-to, and this changes often, but I'd say right now I'm using Valhalla the most.
Yeah, that's a really good one.
Like the vintage verb.
Yeah.
That's just got such a, I don't know, it's it's got such a good sound to it. All their presets are great, and then you can kind of tweak things from there. And just the flexibility you have over that plugin. That's been kind of my go-to lately.
Taking us through like kind of like your mixing process and stuff. What would you say like are some like spatial elements that you think are like really necessary? Because I see all the time there's like some people have like a short verb, a long verb, eighth delay, slap. Like there's a bunch of different things that people use to help create space. What do you think is like a...
So on my kind of vocal bus, once I've done my processing, like on that bus itself, like EQ, compression, saturation, de-essing, whatever, that's when I'll kind of start to get to like bus processing. Like I'll send that out to a bunch of different aux tracks that I have in my session. And that's where I really kind of get my depth. So I'll have usually like a short reverb, which just kind of like, it's almost giving the vibe of a natural room. Yeah. It's not giving me any like long tail end of a reverb or anything like that. It's literally just to kind of give the natural sound of a room, especially if, if someone's recording in a vocal booth or maybe they've got the Chaotica like eyeball kind of thing. I find a lot of times like when people send me records where they, I can almost tell that they were using a Chaotica because it really kind of deads the sound. You know what I mean? And I want life in a vocal. I don't want it to necessarily have that dead sound. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's where like a short reverb comes in, where it just brings back kind of a room sound, but not in like an annoying way, just very subtly. So I'll use that. I'll use a slap delay. That same thing. It's a really kind of quick thing. It almost sounds like a short reverb in a sense, right? That's how I usually use it. And I'll use that a little wider. Like I'll set it to like a ping pong mode or something. So it's kind of going back and forth, but really fast. So it's giving that kind of dimension in the same thing, a really subtle way. A lot of times then I'll put like an actual longer reverb on, which is giving me that more kind of, you know, tail end on a vocal or whatever. Then I'll usually do some sort of like quarter delay, eighth delay, whatever is kind of necessary for the song. Whether we want that faster or slower, that's, you know, to the taste of the song itself. And you can do some cool things like on the delay itself by like maybe you add a reverb to the delay, which gives it some width, but it's only touching the delay, like not the lead vocal, right? So that's another way to kind of add space. A lot of times I'll have like a doubler set up, like with like the Waves doubler or something like that on its own aux track. And maybe I do some EQing underneath that and send the vocal to that, which kind of gives it a bit of width and just kind of opens it up a little bit. But I'm using all these things like super subtly. But when once you start putting all those on, and you're just in the motion of doing it, you might not even notice it necessarily. But then when you A-B it, you turn all those buses off. You're like, oh shit, now I see what it's doing. So it's all those kind of little things. And I say this all the time. It's not about, mixing is not about like moving mountains in one kind of step. It's all these little kind of increments that work up to the big picture, right? So instead of using just one thing to kind of try to do everything, just use everything kind of subtly so that you work up to this kind of big thing, but incrementally. You know what I mean? So those are definitely some of the ways that I'll add dimension and width to a vocal specifically.
Kind of back into like processing vocals. How would you like approach a mix when it's like you have a lead vocal and then like a lot of different like harmonies and stacks under it? How would you process those background vocals?
The golden rule is like, you don't want to process the backgrounds exactly like the lead, right? Because then everything starts to kind of blend together. So a lot of times like I'll EQ the background vocals differently, whether I'm maybe, because a lot of times with my backgrounds, I don't want them to be overly bright. I want my lead vocal to kind of shine and take the star or be the star of the show, right? So my background vocals, maybe I'll dull them down a little bit. A lot of times if I've got harmonies, I'm panning them left and right. And if there is something that I only have mono, maybe I'm adding a doubler on it or something to kind of space it out a bit. Maybe I'm using Pro Q4 to kind of carve out some, you know, you can set like one of the bands or something to just affect the middle.
Like the dynamic or like the mid side.
Exactly. Or you can have it just kind of EQing the sides or something like that.
Yeah.
So I'll pull out some of the mid range, like around the 1,000-2,000 hertz kind of area on my background. So it's kind of pulling away from the lead vocal, which I want kind of right in the middle, right?
Yeah.
So things like that, or maybe I'm compressing the background stuff a little harder. Maybe I'm compressing them a little less if I want them to kind of poke out a bit more. Or maybe I'm adding more saturation. Like I like a lot of times to add like tape kind of saturation to my background vocals, because it kind of warms them up differently from my lead vocal.
Mm-hmm.
So those kind of little steps that just kind of carve out space for them from the lead vocal, I think really kind of helps.
Yeah. And when you're doing all that processing, I assume you're doing it like on a bus, like on an aux track, right?
Yeah.
Or do you do it individually?
No, usually it's on a bus, especially if there's like, if I've got a track with like a bunch of different backgrounds or harmonies or something like that. It makes it a lot easier just to kind of do the main prop. Maybe I've got like one, like, I don't know, maybe I've got an EQ on certain tracks or RVox on certain tracks, something like that. But the main processing is done on a an aux track kind of set to all of them.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. A question I love to ask too is like technique-wise, what's a technique that you learn that you never forgot and like you use all the time and would share with everyone?
Man, there's a bunch, but I'd say maybe lately something that I do a lot is top-down mixing. Where you kind of start with your mix bus before you even touch any individual stems in your track.
Yeah.
So that's something that I do quite often these days is I'll kind of load everything up. I'll load up the beat stems, I'll load up all the vocals, and I'll do kind of a rough like leveling, right? Like I'll kind of just with my faders or just the mouse, whatever, I'll kind of make things sit volume-wise where I want them, but I'm not applying like any compressors, EQs, no nothing yet. I'm just leveling things out. And then from there, when I've got kind of a good balance, then I go up to my mix bus and I start adding some processing there. And I might add gear in right from the start. So I kind of get that sound that I'm getting from the analog stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right off the bat. And I do some kind of processing there first. And that kind of, that gets you like from here to here, like right off the bat before you even touch anything, right? So that's something that I think is really useful. A lot of times, the other thing you've got to think about is when you do that, you've always got to kind of check back on those mix bus things, because once you start, then once you start going into like individual stem processing, and you start applying a bunch of different effects to your bass, your kick, your snare, your vocals, bass, whatever, you've got to kind of check your mix bus stuff. Cause maybe your bus compressor that you have on that mix bus, now that you're adding plugins on everything else, maybe now that mix, the bus compressor is getting hit a little harder, right?
Yeah,
so you've got to keep checking that processing to make sure you're not overdriving anything or adding too much signal into something that you have on it, right?
Yeah.
But that to me is that's a gem that I've started doing that I think can be useful for a lot of people.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. I've heard a lot of people too, because like, sometimes they start with no mix bus and then they just mix everything and then they just try to add stuff at the end. And then it's really hard to just add stuff at the end without making it sound like completely squashed, or like now your whole mix sounds different because you're just adding things on. Compared to if you kind of start with a little bit of it already, it's like that's going to help elevate that mix and make it sound kind of like almost like good from the gut. Like there's a certain tone with the compression and the EQ together that's going to make it sound pretty good from the very beginning. And then once you just add into that and like you said, go back and check it, like I think that's really important.
Well, and that's the thing, because especially if you're using hardware, or even just let's say you're using a Pultec plugin on your mix bus or something like that, even if you don't touch the knobs at all, that Pultec is still giving you a sound.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because I even did a test when I got my the Pultec. I just ran something through it, but didn't touch any of the knobs or anything, right? I just ran signal through it and I pulled up like a Pro-Q 4 just to kind of see on and off, like when I turn it on, there's a ton of, you still get like harmonic saturation just from the unit being on, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you get kind of a color and a tone without touching anything. Mm-hmm. And that could alter the sound of your mix, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you start with that plugin or hardware and you're starting with that kind of stuff, so you're getting that color, you're getting that tone right from the beginning and you're mixing into it, it can be cool because now you know kind of what to apply and how things are going to sound more finished. Whereas opposed to if you do your whole mixing, like individual stem mixing or whatever, and then you start adding, you know, you add your bus compressor, you add a Poltec or whatever style you want, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Then your mix could start to change because it's like that gear without even touching anything has a sound to it.
Yeah.
So that could alter your whole mix. And then you've got to go back and change things on individual stems or something like that, right?
Yeah.
So that's kind of my philosophy of sometimes it's good to just kind of throw it on right from the start.
Yeah.
And not necessarily like limiters, but like anything that kind of adds color or texture or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Cause not even like, that's one of the main reasons why I love analog gear is cause it's not even for the sake of like using it for the tool it's meant to do. It's the sound and the color and like the tone in it without it actually being like sometimes even on or like compressing anything. Like you said, like you plugged in the Poltec one and then from the get-go, there's like a saturation to it already.
Exactly.
Without turning up any knobs or adding any EQ. It's just built into it.
And that's a nice thing about gear because it's all you're running through the transformers or the tubes or whatever. Mm-hmm. That just kind of adds something that plugins try to get, but they just can't quite get them as close as the real thing, in my opinion.
Yeah. You kind of walked us through like your mix bus a little bit in the beginning, like with your analog gear. Is there anything that you'll go back into Pro Tools and then do in the box as well?
Yeah, totally. There's a few things that I still do in the box on my mix bus.
Mm-hmm.
I'll usually always kind of start with a Pro Q4.
Yeah.
Just to kind of like, and not necessarily, I don't necessarily do anything to it at the start if I'm doing that like top-down approach. Mm-hmm. I just kind of have it there for afterwards when I need it.
Yeah.
So that'll be the first thing that I do is a digital thing.
Mm-hmm.
But after I kind of do my mix, I'll use that just to kind of do like any like minor, like little tweaks to the whole song that I feel like it needs, like frequency wise.
Yeah.
I'll do that. And then I usually run it out to, I'll usually kind of lock things in with the bus compressor first.
Mm-hmm.
And then run into like the Poltec or SSL Fusion that I have.
Oh, that's nice.
Then go into like some saturation with the Rupert Neve, the 542s, the tape emulators. And then get some stereo imaging with the SPL Big. And then I'll usually jump back into Pro Tools after that. And I don't know, maybe I've got like, if I feel like it's necessary, maybe I'll kind of like just soothe things a bit with like a multiband compressor.
Yeah.
Or Soothe 2 I like a lot sometimes. Mm-hmm. And just using them very subtly, maybe after I applied my gear, maybe now my low end is a little bit too heavy. So that's where I'll use a multiband to kind of like dynamically kind of pull it down a little bit, for instance. And then I'll usually get to my clipping or limiting after that as well in the box.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like start in the box, then the middle of my chain is analog, and then I finish it in the box as well.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. Just curious, what type of limiter do you use?
This could change. I'd say most times these days I'm using FabFilter's Pro L2.
Yeah, I love that one.
Yeah, it's just you can get color from it if you want. You can keep it transparent. Mm-hmm. I find myself these days using that a lot. Another one that I think a lot of people don't use is the Slate Digital limiter. I'm drawing a blank on the name now. It's like the FGX or something like that.
Well, I think I've maybe heard of that one. I'd have to check it out more.
It's cool though, man. I use that a lot. Or the UAD, the Oxford limiter.
Oh yeah. I switch in between those two a lot. I find doing like the podcast stuff, I kind of like how clean the Oxford one is. So I'll like I'll use that rather than like a FabFilter one.
Sure.
But yeah, that one's really good too. There's a lot of controls on it too. And like, especially that like enhance feature as well. Like you can really get some more like saturation with it if needed.
Exactly.
But yeah. No, that's a good plugin.
Yeah. Those are two. So those like three are kind of like some of my go-tos at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, I got the Sonox version of the Oxford limiter because
yeah, sure.
It's funny, I mention this every episode, but I'm like totally out of UAD DSP on mixes when it comes to mixing.
Yeah.
Like I need to get a satellite. I need to figure that out. But
sure.
Yeah, that's the one downside to the UAD stuff. It's like they're so good, but you need like a bunch of stuff in order to run the DSP.
Do you have a like a twin?
Yeah, I was going to say, I only have the twin. Because like, as I was just saying that, I was like, for you, it's probably no big deal because you have the twin and the 8 one. So,
yeah. But that, trust me, I know that struggle, man. Like before I got the X8, I was constantly running out of DSP. And I ended up getting a satellite, which I kind of regret, to be honest.
Oh, really?
It's just like, you kind of just get that when you're in that stage just because it's like, yeah, I need that. So you'll go out and spend $1,000 where you could... Like you could like just sell or just save that $1,000 and sell your twin and just upgrade to like an X6 or an X8.
Yeah.
Especially if you think you're going to get more into gear, right?
Yeah.
It'll future proof you a bit. And even me, like I'm at the stage now where I wish I would have got the X16 instead of the X8.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Because now I'm completely out of IO space. So if I get one more piece of gear, I don't even have my SSL Fusion in my rack right now because I just don't have the IO space for it. And it sucks because that's a fantastic piece of gear that I just have like collecting dust at the moment, you know?
Yeah.
So I always say like, if you think that there's a potential of you getting more into gear, like in your home studio, instead of going with getting a satellite just to kind of deal with your plugins at the, like for the time being, maybe consider like upgrading to the X8 or the X6 or something like that.
Yeah.
Just to kind of future-proof yourself a bit, and you'll get the DSP over that as well.
Yeah, no, that's a very good way to look at that too, because I never thought about that. Because I have looked into the satellites, and it feels wrong spending so much on something that doesn't do anything. If you know what I mean, it's like a big hard drive that just sits there so you can use plugins. Like, let's say I got like the 8 or the 6, it's like that has so many more features that you can use. Like if I wanted to record a drum kit now you could with that, or like anything. Like it's way more flexible. And I never even thought about using those for outboard gear either. So
yeah, man.
Yeah. Do you run them through like the line inputs like to get into it or?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Just line in, line out at the back of the interface.
Oh yeah. That's very smart. I definitely need to look into that now because that makes a lot more sense. And it's also, it's very clean. Like if you think about it, like the way you're doing it, like that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, exactly. And I think just in general, like because UAD is with their like Spark stuff, like the monthly subscriptions that you don't need, they just run natively.
Mm-hmm.
They, I think eventually like satellites and DSP in general will be a thing of the past. Yeah. I don't know how long that's going to take, but I think eventually, because they've already started it, right?
Mm-hmm.
By making a good chunk of their plugins native where you don't need DSP, right?
Yeah.
So I think eventually they're going to shift towards that more and just eventually all their plugins, like you won't need DSP. So that's why I think like satellites aren't the greatest investment right now.
Yeah.
So I think eventually they will become like an extinct piece of equipment.
Yeah. That's why I haven't gotten one either. Like I'm kind of getting into the habit of just like using them wisely and routing and learning to print things as well.
Yeah.
But when it comes to putting them on an aux, it's like, I'm fucked. It's like, there's no way.
Yeah.
There's no way of changing that. But
especially when you're using them on like on a stereo aux, because they take up more if it's stereo, right? So
Yeah.
And some of those ones that are just like, they eat up so much DSP. Like,
I know.
It's brutal.
Like any of the preamps, especially like when I'm recording and stuff, like I use the 1073 all the time, but that one takes like 43% just having it on, just ready to go. And then I have to work around my like recording template or work around the stuff I'm doing based on that one. But I'm interested in getting, they have like the Neve 1073 preamp, like just the dial plugin that like is known to be like, so, like super low in DSP. So I need to get that rather than the other one that's taking up like half the twin. But
yeah, like if you just want that Neve sound and that's all you kind of need, then that makes total sense.
Yeah. I haven't been using it a lot to track recently because the studio at my work, like we have like an SSL. So I've been running that into an 1176 as my like, sound. So I've been using that a lot and I'm liking the tone of it.
Oh, totally, man. You can't go wrong with that. Then the sound of an SSL board is fantastic.
Yeah, because like for the longest time, I never used it. I would use my own stuff because I use Logic a lot too. Yeah. And I like having my own laptop because I have access to like my plugins on my Twin and all of that stuff and just having a little bit more control with that. But sure. I kind of taught myself. Like I really took the time to like study and learn on my own, like so I can run the SSL or my mic into this snake going into the SSL into the compressor. And then I just take the line out of my compressor and put it on my line in of my Twin and then ready to go. It's like, it's very easy and the tone of it's nice. And I don't know about you either, but like when I'm like tracking vocals for people and stuff, like I do all my monitoring inside of console and like there's no latency at all. You can have so much control of like how the artist was sound in headphones. And I think that to me is like super important and super, it's a really good way if anyone out there is like struggling with latency. Cause I know there's some people that only use certain plugins because they're low latency and it won't affect their recording or won't affect the performance. But it's like, that to me, it honestly is like such a thing of the past. Cause I haven't had to deal with that. Just using console and using the chains in there. And it's a great platform.
I totally get that, man. I'm me personally, I always just kind of do my stuff in Pro Tools when I'm recording. But like you said, I keep things like very simple when I'm recording. Yeah. There's a lot of people where they've got like a ton of different plugins on and stuff like that. But I like to keep things fairly simple when I'm actually recording. So I don't, and I'm not using any like UAD stuff when I record. Mm-hmm. So it's mainly like the things I'll have on during a recording session will be like same thing, Pro Q4, just maybe roll off some low end, maybe a bit of a high boost or something like that.
Yeah.
I've got the Waves de-esser. And usually like RVox or RComp. So these are all like low latency plugins that don't give me any issues, right? And then I'll usually have like a reverb on or something like that.
Yeah.
But same thing, like just something that doesn't give me any latency, you know? Yeah. But I don't like having like a ton of stuff on when I'm recording, especially at my place too, because I'm running you through some good gear already.
Exactly.
So going in, it's already sounding like pretty clean and stuff, right?
Yeah, I was just about to say that too. Like a preamp and a compressor on their own will already take like a recording from like here to here already because it's making it sound almost like a mix in a way where it's like
totally
creating a tone that's like making the artist sound like feel confident and comfortable rather than just recording from like a mic in on just like a
preamp. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. So if you have because I know like outboard gear gets expensive and not everybody can afford it, right?
Yeah.
But even if you just get a good mic and you're in like a somewhat of a treated room, you know what I mean? Man, that can make the world of a difference.
Yeah.
You don't need like all this other like outboard gear, especially when you're starting out. Like I tell people this all the time, like, it's nice to have, but build up to that where you can actually like comfortably afford a external preamp or compressor or something like that. Like, don't feel like you need it when you're just kind of starting out.
Yeah.
A good mic and not even like it doesn't have to be a U87 or something like that.
Yeah.
You can start where you can start with what you can afford and then upgrade as you start, you know, getting better or getting more clients and more money coming in. So just, it's all about just working with what you have and making the best out of it.
Mm-hmm. I think I've noticed too recently, because like starting out, you want your stuff to be like perfect and you want it to sound great and whatever. But honestly, like a big portion of making a record too comes down to the mix of how things are mixed and how they sound. Because like, for example, a friend of mine showed me like a song that they did and we're asking for like mixing feedback. And I was like, it sounds really good. It sounds good already. Like, what mic did you use? And they're like, oh, a Rode NT1A. I was like, I never would have guessed that. Because the way it was mixed, it sounded good. Even though it's
totally,
like,
man,
that's like a cheaper starting out mic. It's like, I would have honestly never known that because the way it got mixed was really good. And it was like, this sounds good on its own.
Yeah, man. There's been a couple times where I've had somebody send me some vocals and I've been like, oh, this sounds really clean. Like, what's your setup like? And those couple times they've been like, it's just Audio Technica like 2020 going into a Focusrite.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what? Like, how is that even possible? But it could just be like where they've got their mic set up in their room, or maybe it's just it's a dead sounding room. Or I always tell like people that record at home, like if you're just in your bedroom and nothing's treated, like you don't have any panels or anything set up, the sound is going everywhere a lot of the time, right? But I tell people, like, when you're recording, just put your mic stand and your mic in like your closet where you've got a bunch of clothes, you know?
Yeah.
And that'll kind of really dead the sound instead of having it right in the middle of your room. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And sometimes you can get away with just inexpensive mics or gear by simply placing the mic in a good spot.
Yeah.
Like mic placement is almost more important than the stuff itself, man.
Yeah.
Because I've had artists that have worked with me like numerous times, and these are like artists that have a bit of money, mm-hmm. and they've been like, Ty, what mic is this? And what preamp do you use? I'm like, okay, I've got the Neumann U87 and it goes into the 1073. Mm-hmm. They're like, okay, I'm going to go out and buy that. And they do that and they spend a bag on this stuff mm-hmm. and start recording at home. And then they send me vocals and I'm like, what the, like, are you sure you got the same mic and stuff? Because it sounds terrible, right? But it's like I asked them like where they're recording in their house or whatever. And they're like, oh, I'm just like right in the basement. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, is it just a big wide open basement? They're like, yeah. I'm like, well, there's your problem. You've got so much reverb coming back into your mic that it sounds like shit, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's the thing, man. Mic placement and just recording properly can make the world of a difference, even just with lower level equipment.
Yeah, even back to what you said about like not needing the gear right away too. Like I think a good way to look at it too is if you're going to buy a piece of gear, it's like make sure you understand how to use it first.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like understand back to what you were saying, like with the harmonic saturation, like all of that stuff, like learn what it's going to do to your mix or your recording before starting to like just like spending all the money and then getting it. It's like, oh, I have this, but I don't really know how to use it. It's like really learning kind of, especially with you, and I'd assume with all the gear that you have, like you really like understand certain tricks to use with it, certain things to do, when not to use it, because you have a good understanding of when and how to use it as well.
For sure, man. And it was always, I've always based my gear choices off, let's just say like I've been in other studios, like bigger studios in Toronto or wherever, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Where I have like plethora of outboard gear to my disposal. I can use like anything, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So during those kind of sessions, I would always like experiment a little bit with different compressors or different preamps and that kind of thing, just to see like what my personal taste was, you know what I mean? And if I noticed I kept using that 1073 or I kept using that 1176, like that's why I got those two pieces of gear, because I always liked those, like when I was in like another bigger studio, right?
Yeah.
Or the other reason why I make gear purchases is because I'm always using like the plugin. Mm-hmm. Like I was always using like the Moog EQ4, for instance, right?
Yeah.
In like a mixing session. So I was like, okay, let me like look into this. Maybe I can get the real thing. And so that's the other reason of why. And within reason, you know what I mean? Because mm-hmm. I love, like I said earlier, I love Fairchild like compressors. But I'm not fucking spending 15 grand or 20 grand on an outboard. You know what I mean? Like there's got to be, you got to work within what you can actually like afford, you know?
Yeah.
And it's all, you know, it's levels and there's perspective to it. You know what I mean? Cause somebody could look at the Moog EQ4 and be like, well, that's out of my price range. And it's like, that's fine, but just get something that is within your price range and then work up to like these kind of things. It's all levels to it, you know?
Yeah. And you also have to think about it too. Like if you're thinking about like the money wise of it all, it's like, is getting like a $16,000 Fairchild compressor really going to elevate your mix so much than just using, like, is it going to sound like a $16,000 record at the end of the day if you buy it?
Yeah, exactly, man.
Yeah.
Like how long is it going to take you to pay that off kind of thing?
Yeah. Cause that's,
you know,
$16,000 for a compressor is crazy.
It's insane. Yeah. I mean, gear has gone up so much in price lately. Yeah. It's absurd.
Especially like microphones too. Like I always just think like, what if there's an artist in the studio with like the 251 and they just drop it? It's like,
speak to them.
That's like, oh, we'll just give them money. And then to like the engineer, that's like my whole like life saving. Like
no shit, man. Yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah.
I was looking at like Universal Audio stuff the other day. Mm-hmm. I was on Long & McQuaid's website and I saw like the LA-2A is going for like, after tax, it'd be like 10 grand Canadian right now.
That's crazy.
Isn't that insane?
Yeah.
It's just gone up so much in price lately.
Yeah. That's, wow.
Yeah, it was like it was like 80 something hundred bucks, but then when you add the tax on, it's like just under 10 grand.
Yeah.
And I'm like, for a mono compressor, that's absolutely insane to me.
Yeah, like even like, because I was looking at the CO1B, which I find is like a very like common compressor used too. And I think that one goes for like, I haven't done it with tax after, but I'd probably say like 6,000 maybe, like a little bit cheaper than 2A, but wow. Yeah.
That's why like all these like companies like Audioscape or Stam Audio, like those kind of things, they're killing it right now because they come out with these products that are clones of the main things.
Yeah.
But man, I'm telling you, they're so close like to the originals.
That's good.
Because a lot of times like with UA or whoever else, like you're paying for the name of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like sure, they're using better components in a couple different like spots, but like for the most part, man, like if you get the Audioscape 2A, like the one that I have, I've used 2A, like real 2As in studios like numerous times over like my career. And when I got this one, I was like, holy shit, like this is so close to a real 2A.
Okay. That's good to know.
And it's, and it's like $1,300 like US.
Wow.
So it's like, it's a fraction of the price of the real thing. And it's like, if the real LA-2A is right here, then the Audioscape's like right underneath it.
Wow. Okay. That's good to know. Cause I've always looked at stuff like that to be like, oh, well, it can't sound as good as like the normal one or whatever. But if you're saying it's pretty close, then
you'd be surprised how good they are these days, man.
Yeah. Just throw a sticker on the label. I'm just like, change it.
Exactly.
Who's going to know?
Exactly. That's it.
Yeah. To kind of like wrap up the podcast a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there any advice you'd like to give to any upcoming music creators or engineers about like just something that you wish you could know when you were starting out as well?
Well, the main advice that I always give people, and you know, people always ask me this, like, what can I do earlier on? I'm just starting out kind of thing. The main thing I always tell people, and this might be kind of generic, but it's like, have patience.
Yeah.
Because nothing's going to pop off overnight. It's it's a long grind. And especially if you're doing it on your own and you're just figuring things out as you go. Because you might be a great engineer and your stuff sounds good, but you've got to figure out the business aspect of it too.
Yeah.
How do you market yourself? How do you brand yourself? How do you find new clients? How do you keep clients? How do you get people coming back? How do you price yourself? All that kind of stuff, right? So you've got to kind of figure that out as you go. And it can take time like to really build that and just figure things out. So patience is like the biggest thing you could have. And I'm not talking like it's going to be a few weeks or a few months. You could be talking like a few years before you start like really kind of making some decent money or just paying your bills from it kind of thing.
Yeah.
So the patience is crucial, man. Mm-hmm. The other thing is really just like, just get good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And just like hone in on your craft and practice. And even to this day, man, every morning I wake up, jump in the shower, I make my breakfast and I bring my breakfast in here, or I'm sitting out in my living room and I'm right on YouTube looking at other like engineers.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's like bigger engineers or just like guys with 2,000 subscribers that are very small, but hey, they put this video out and I find it cool.
Yeah.
And maybe I can learn something from that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So my point is just always learn. Like every day, you can always learn something new or, you know, get advice from other engineers that are a little more established or they've been in the game for a while. So just always learn, always practice, always put the time in to make yourself better and that, you know, like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So those two things specifically are like just super crucial, the patience and just putting the time in.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. Cause I find too, like even yourself, I find the videos that you put out on social media and stuff, like they're really like helpful for other engineers too.
Yeah,
and I think
for sure.
That's like, it's great that the engineering community kind of does that stuff where they're sharing what they know with the people all around them. Cause like you said, it's like even you, an established like engineer, you're constantly learning from other people as well, because they're so, mixing is so crazy and there's so many things to learn about it too. It's like, and people create different techniques and stuff too.
Yeah.
And like maybe watching like that 2,000 subscriber guy, like maybe his technique like changes your opinion on something that you do, and then you try it out and you're like, I'm going to add this to my workflow. Yeah. And I'm going to do this because it's great. And yeah, I love that engineering is becoming a little bit more like well-known. And that's something with this podcast too. I want to help engineers and people that don't even know what an engineer is, like really learn new skills and new tricks.
Totally. Exactly. Like
yeah.
Well, and yeah. And that's a good thing, man. Cause it's like with the stuff that I'm kind of putting out, like content wise and stuff like that, it's all stuff that I would have wanted to know when I was starting out. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that I can try to maybe help someone do things a little quicker kind of thing.
For sure.
You know what I mean? Cause it took me a while. Cause back then, like I said, there wasn't as much information or just videos or tutorials out there as there are today. Right.
Yeah.
So it's like things like that I would have wanted to know, whether it's like business things, whether it's mixing techniques or stuff about gear or whatever. It's just all things that I think could help an engineer starting out or just building their career.
Yeah. That's amazing too. Cause I say it too. It's like in this community, it's like there's no need to like gatekeep anything or like gatekeep certain like techniques or all of this so you can be the best engineer or whatever. It's like, no, like we should all be like looking out for each other and like sharing with each other and
exactly
learning from each other too, I think is really important.
Bro, there's enough work for everyone to go around.
Yeah.
That's always been my philosophy. Mm-hmm. It's like, and I've got a lot of different like colleagues and other engineers that I talk to on a daily basis, man, whether that's, you know, texting, phone calls or just, you know, DMs on Instagram or something. And we're always like sharing things or helping each other out or bouncing ideas off each other or, you know, maybe gear purchases or that kind of thing. And it's awesome, man, because there's some stuff that I might not know that this other engineer knows and I'll pick his brain on that. And he has no problem giving me advice because I'll do the same for him. Right.
Yeah.
So it's like you said, it's a good community most times. There's some engineers that are a little standoffish, but I'd say for the most part, everyone's very kind of open and just wanting to help and get help at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being on this podcast and
sharing
your experience and the techniques that you know with everyone. And thanks to everyone watching the Record Lab podcast for listening. And I hope everyone here learned something today.
Yeah. No, thank you for having me, man. This was this was a good talk.
Yeah, for sure. Bye, guys.